Please be seated.
So, pick your brains type questions as you hear. Firstly, do you have any knowledge through your client or through general practice about deem permits?
Very little.
Okay. And so one of the we've got legal questions and then we've got some planning questions around deem permits. Putting the legal issues aside, you know, there's a question, well, subject to the legal issue or outcome, there's a question of, you know, do we need to be doing something in this space? Can we do something in this space? What should we do in this space? Because my broad understanding is come 1 October, then deemed permits simply cease to exist. They're a creature of statute.
Mm.
And what had been imagined by government 30 years ago when it enacted the RMA is that there would be a fit-for-purpose water plan, which would replace those deemed permits, but there's not.
Mm-hmm.
And so is there kind of a policy gap in this plan change, or is there not? Because council has also had a policy of late of encouraging farmers to enter into more collective arrangements, and those collective arrangements, particularly through flow sharing agreements, but there may be other mechanisms, have already taken or have taken over or have the capacity to take over those deemed permits. So I was trying to get a feel for any of that. And do you have a feel for any for anything to do with that?
is there a gap flow sharing arrangements and whether there's
Whether there's a policy gap? Because we've heard evidence, and it's not helpful. We've not heard from farmers. That would be helpful. But we've heard evidence, oh, it's going to be chaos. And it's like the basis of that, we don't know. It may be, it may not be.
My experience with water user groups and flow sharing arrangements is predicated around those arrangements being farmers working together to achieve a particular outcome, so to keep flows above a minimum level, for example. And the minimum level is a condition of all of their resource consents, and the flow sharing arrangement sits outside of that as a cooperative way of making sure the flow never hits that threshold. I don't have any experience with it where it relates to keeping water available for another user. That's much more complicated.
That's really what we're talking about, actually. So the flow sharing arrangement's not tied to a minimum flow in a permit, either an existing permit or a place permit, but is tied to the collective interests of a catchment or sub-catchment to ensure that water is available for all users, and that restrictions start to come down in a way which is equitable and fair across all users. And so that would be what I was thinking of, and you've no experience of that?
No, not with having implemented something like that, no. I can see that you could craft plan provisions or resource consent conditions which set out who must cease taking at certain times in order to keep the water available for a downstream user. That, I think, would require a consideration of all the consents in the catchment at the same time. It would be a quasi-regional plan. And seeing as we don't have one, that might not be very helpful.
And so others have said, oh, well, you just have to refer to the word priorities and it just kind of all happens. And that might be so, in as much as the priorities which have been in place for over 100 years or so, if they have been exercised, and again, we have no evidence about whether they are exercised, the extent of their exercise, or the circumstances when they're exercised, and that can change, I imagine, every year and every season. We have no evidence about that. But the evidence we had from two parties, at least, was just say the word priorities and it would all happen. In this plan change, if you say the word priorities, it would all happen. Now, that might be I don't know whether that is so. It all, something might happen if it had some legal benefit to the permit holder, or maybe nothing would happen if it had no benefit, no existing right, or I don't know. You got any thoughts on that? Say the word. Well, firstly, first proposition is to include priorities as a matter which is a matter of control. Does that assume, in fact, that there is a continuing right in priority which can be recognised after 1 October?
I think it would. My understanding is that the rights of priority are deemed consent conditions.
On a deemed permit.
And this is a new slate in a way, getting a water permit.
Yes.
Except to the extent that the plan change already says if there are conditions on the permit already, they should be rolled over.
Yeah, well, that's the technical legal issue, is a deemed a deemed condition on a deemed permit, a creature of statute which ceases to exist after the 1st of October, regardless of what anybody else might think, or is that not quite right? It can somehow survive. And so that's the vexed legal question. And I thought, well, yes, there's that, and we'll get an answer out of that. But is there some other planning response that, if you like, mimics what's going on with priorities? And, yes.
Well, that would be defining the flows at which those priorities apply.
Okay, so the very thing that's not been done.
Needs to be done, yeah.
All right. Okay. Any other mechanisms that can be brought down to encourage collective organisation? Sounds like a union now, but collective arrangements. Other than, well, including also the policies which are in the operative plan.
I noted in the minute a question about carrying over some matters of discretion.
Yeah, well, they were just my... They're the matters of discretion in the operative plan, and so that was me brainstorming again, looking for solutions. If we have a problem, looking for solutions,
Yes. And you could carry those over into the controlled and restricted discretionary rule, but in order to utilise those matters of discretion, the consent conditions would have to define flows and times. Again, we're back to the same problem. We don't have that information. So then I think you are left with the non-regulatory approach that seems to be operating at the moment in the region. When people get along, that works quite well. But doesn't translate to a condition of consent very well, I wouldn't expect.
No. And those non-regulatory methods, because that's how I describe priorities in particular, and first sharing agreements too, at least what we've learned about them, they can be signalled and encouraged through policy in this plan change in the same way or much the same way as the operative plan has. But what it's doing is just signalling.
Yes.
Okie dokie.
The only other way I've seen it operate is a group of irrigated or water takers applying as a group for certain amount of water and certain flow regimes or minimum flows, and then exercising that global consent by agreement amongst them. In which case they manage the achievement of the conditions by managing their takes by agreement, and then the council doesn't need to be involved in what that agreement looks like. And that I have seen that work.
And I think it's possibly already in the region and some replace permits, which are... But that again, only that comes down through a large permit with minimum flows, recessions, concessions, and all the rest. and flow, and then the flow sharing itself is as per what irrigators want to do, but sitting outside the oversight of the regional council.
Mm.
But again, it depends on this other, you know, somebody putting up a comprehensive application with minimum flows. And it's not that's not this process. This process isn't intending to impose.
No, the no, this process doesn't impose that. It would have to be by agreement.
Could this process, and I haven't thought this next comment out at all, so don't take anything out of it. If that is what is proposed, if it is in fact a gap and there is risk within catchments, sub-catchments, and risk to existing relationships with abstractors, is that something that could be proposed without any other change? So, in other words, a voluntary minimum flow and recession, if it is suggested, that could be, as a way for tying people over, that could be proposed, and that doesn't have to come with a merits-based assessment for a large-scale increase in irrigation area or anything else.
Yes, I can't see any barrier to...
Any barriers to a voluntary proposal.
A voluntary approach, no.
Well, that is one method.
Mm.
And it could be quite an effective method.
It could be, yes.
As between relationships, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, do you know, and you may not... anything about Schedule 2A, all my questions from about paragraph 12 onwards. Do you know anything about that? Double check, sorry. Yeah, no, my question's from 12, 13 and 14. Knowledge about catchments inside and outside Schedule 2A. Do you know anything about those catchments and
about
permit consenting?
About the consenting, no.
No, okay,
no,
so I won't ask you that. All right. Those are my questions. Commissioner, have you got any questions?
Nothing
my questions.
Me,
so anything arising from the court's examination? You do, yep. We'll come to you last because you should go last because it's your witness, okay? No, yes?
Thank you. Commissioner Edmonds asked you some questions in relation to the utility of the first matter to which the council reserves its control. So matter of control A.
Yes.
And I wonder whether perhaps the purpose of matter of control A was as simple as providing a platform to the council to impose conditions in relation to those matters, reflecting the entry conditions on the rule, simply so that there was simply a hook for council to put conditions on these things.
I imagine originally that was its intended purpose, yes.
Thank you. No further questions.
Now, do you have any questions? Nobody else? So, do you have any questions? Arising from the court's own questions?
No, Your Honour.
Okay, all right, thank you. Well, thank you very much. Your evidence has been really helpful indeed. All of your witnesses have been very helpful, very informative, so we're very grateful to have had them along. All right, and probably we'll see you at a later date. I may be, just depending on how we're going with the schedule and other questions that the court might have. All right, thank you very much. That's your case, isn't it? Okay, good. All right. Okay, so who are we moving to next?
Good afternoon, Your Honour and Commissioners. Council's name is Miss Ford for Horticulture New Zealand. Just before we get going with my legal submissions, I'd like to introduce the team very briefly. Mm-hmm. We've got three of our experts with us today. We've got Michelle Sands, who's the Manager of Natural Resources for Horticulture New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
Vance Hodson, who's our planner, mm-hmm. and he attended the expert planning conferencing as well, and Stuart Ford, who's our economist. Mm-hmm. And you heard from Anne McIndoe as part of the ORUG presentation back in March.
Yep.
So we had joint evidence with him. Mm-hmm. We've also got two growers with us today.
Two who? Growers.
Growers.
All right, yeah.
We've got Mr. Ernsty Weaver, who is a director of Leaning Rock Cherries in Cromwell, and Simon Webb as well, who's Webb's Fruit, who you'll see
just
on the main highway.
Okay.
With some timing constraints and some circumstances for Mr. Weaver, he has a funeral to go to tomorrow. So what... and some timing constraints with flights and travel and stuff. What I propose is to have me present the legal submissions, move to Mr. Weaver's evidence and his statement, and then Mr. Ford for economics, and then move into Ms. Sands and Mr. Hodson, following up with Mr. Webb to round out our case.
Okay, very good. Now, you heard me ask a lot of questions from the last witness about my minute and my minute concerning deem permits. Do we have a problem? If we do, what's the nature of the problem? How do we plug that one? My expectation and direction was that all of your witnesses have seen that, have a copy of that minute. Have they had it?
Apologies, Your Honour. It is something that slipped my radar. They have it now.
Good. Because...
and we would like to have more of a discussion about it tonight, but our initial view is that it's something that if we were going to address it, it would have to be across all of our experts.
Well, I was also really interested in the farmers, you see. The experts might have something to say, but what we're actually missing in this hearing is good evidence from farmers and...
On that issue,
they don't have to answer all the technical stuff that are put out there, but I want to know something about deem permits.
Both of our growers are really keen to just have a conversation with you.
Okay, good.
So that they can tell you, like, answer these questions for you. Mr. Ernsty, the orchard there, is a part of the Manahiri Kiri Care Scheme. And so that he might have some really good insights there, but I would suggest just talk to him.
Very good. And thinking about that, because it is a conversation, we'll probably swear your witnesses, just so that there can be no criticism at a later stage that they weren't on their oath,
okay,
et cetera. So it's still no different in terms of the look and feel. It's still a conversation.
Yes.
Yeah, except, you know, obviously, promise to tell the truth in the conversation.
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Your Honour.
All right. Very good. All right. So we're in your hands for your opening.
So you should have copies of my opening in front of you. And I would just like to, as I tabled it today, I would just like to run you through it as we go. So Horticulture New Zealand supports the transitional and interim intent of Plan Change 7. And notes that it's intended to provide an interim regulatory framework for the replacement of expiring deem permits and other expiring water permits while the new land and water plan is developed and until that becomes operative. For HortNZ, it is vital that the horticultural growers in the region have enough certainty of water supply for their businesses to continue to be viable. We support other primary production and water user groups such as ORUG and the other primary sector groups here, to the extent that the plan change, as it was notified, I'd just like to make this clear that with how the plan change has developed through the course of this hearing, there was the general opposition to the plan change initially, and how this has developed while, and I've been informed today that ORUG taking stock of where they're at now as an example, but we don't oppose the withdrawal of the plan change, but it is not something that we're seeking. We are now in the position, as you would have seen with Mr. Hodson's evidence that was provided on Tuesday, we're quite comfortable with where the plan change provisions have landed as a result of the expert conferencing, and that's the line that we'll be taking going forward.
All right, thank you.
So paragraph 4 there just sets out that position, how it's developed through the expert conferencing and the hearing, and we consider that the changes made to Plan Change 7 in the 8 April version, which I refer to and is appended to Mr. Hodson's evidence, resolve the issues raised in our original submission. I'd just like to note that the court has already heard lengthy submissions traversing all of the relevant legal matters, and Hort does not wish to repeat what's already been said. And these submissions will focus on an overview of the relevant contextual matters to our submission and our updated position following the various iterations and changes that have been made to Plan Change 7 up to and including the planning conferencing. As an overview of horticulture, New Zealand, Hort NZ is an industry good body representing the interests of commercial fruit and vegetable growers. Its mission is to provide a unifying vision for the horticulture sector, which increases collaboration between product sector, regional and district groups, and enhances the sector's ability to respond to and influence decisions that affect it, and to develop and encourage industry-wide projects which benefit all growers. Hort NZ participates in regulatory and legal proceedings on behalf of growers nationwide to ensure the best outcome is secured not only for growers but for the continued food security of all New Zealanders. Over the years, Hort NZ has refined its submissions in these regulatory proceedings, having been guided by what is occurring at the national level. In addition, Hort NZ has been assisted by a dedicated expert team who have provided the detailed technical work that underpins the organisation's position. Our submission on Plan Change 7 and further position sought an efficient, effective and fair regulatory framework that provides for greater security for the Otago region and for horticulture. We sought a controlled activity status for the renewal of deemed permits and water permits, amendments to the definitions, policies, rules and Schedule 10A.4, and a viable consenting pathway for deemed permits and water permit renewals that do not meet the control conditions. As I've already noted, PC7 has been and continues to be a contentious issue within the region, and it is the view of Hort NZ that a good middle ground between the primary sector parties, environmental groups and council seems to have been found through the course of the hearing and the expert conferencing, as shown through the 14 March version of in Mr. De Pausmaker's supplementary evidence and the 8 April version that came out of the expert planning conferencing. Horticulture in Otago is quite a unique situation, as it has a unique production capability and plays a critical role in the national food production system. The Otago region supports a variety of fruit and vegetable crops. Vegetables are mainly grown in the Waitaki district, and the central Otago district is the key area for growing summer fruit. It is the combination of the soil and climate which makes central Otago especially suited for growing high-quality crops, and it is well known for its stone fruit, such as cherries, apricots, peaches, nectarines and pit fruits. There is also a wide variety of vegetables grown in the region, which include but is not limited to yams, carrots, courgettes, leeks, cabbage, pumpkin and potatoes. Due to the variety of fruit and vegetables produced, a range of water requirements are needed in the region. A one-size-fits-all consenting approach is not appropriate. A cascade of consent options needs to be available for growers so that consent applications can be tailored to a grower's particular activity. For example, vegetable crops can be more versatile in the location they are grown, as the crops are replanted each year, and so shorter-term consents may be appropriate. In contrast, an orchard requires significant infrastructure, time and planting costs before a return on investment is seen, or the first commercial crop can be harvested, and so a longer-term consent is required. For these reasons, Hort NZ supports a consenting pathway which provides for the variety of circumstances and water requirements which arise in the Otago region. The next section there, Your Honour, is just outlining our experts and who's presenting as part of Hort's team, which I've run through already. So we've got Ian, who you've heard from, Michelle, Stuart, Mr. Hodson, Mr. Weaver and Mr. Webb. As part of Mr. Hodson's evidence in Appendix A, he attached the provisions of the plan change as it was written at the expert planning conference. And I'd just like to make a note there that the comment boxes that are recorded in that PDF indicate that there is more work to be done to carry through that maxima.
And we're aware of that. I think you're in the same position as the last party, which is that in all other respects, that is in fact the JWS, which was signed as of the 8th of April. It's a different document to the one that's come into court insofar as the comment boxes weren't there, but we, they're not particularly relevant to the court, though the court already is aware of their contents and understands what's being signalled as in the comment box.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I just wanted to bring your attention that those are changes that are, were to be followed through.
Yes, no, yes. I know that.
Just to make that clear.
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic. So moving into plan change 7 at paragraph 15, Your Honour, as you know, it's obviously a ministerial call-in. And as a call-in, the appeals can only be made on points of law. This makes the outcome of this hearing incredibly important to all parties. The plan change itself was intended to provide an interim planning framework to enable the transition of deemed permits and other expiring water permits to be updated and resource consents updated to resource consents prior to the land and water regional plan being developed and notified. We have talked quite a lot about the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management 2020. And that came into force in September last year, which replaced the 2017 National Policy Statement. The Regional Council must give effect to the NPS 2020 as soon as reasonably practical, and it has committed to do so by having a new NPSFM 2020 compliant framework in place by the 31st of December 2023 so that Plan Change 7 can remain process-based and transitional. This will be achieved, the implementation of the NPS 2020 will be achieved through the new regional policy statement due to be notified in June this year, and then the new land and water regional plan to be notified in December 2023. The effect of the NPSFM on HortNZ's position is that the provision of fruit and vegetables plays a crucial role in providing for the health of all New Zealanders and therefore must be enabled through the planning hierarchy. Inclusion of select environmental outcomes, which are to be set through the National Objectives Framework of the NPSFM 2020, should not be included in PC7, as this selection could lead to a judgment of outcomes that are important, despite Council not having undertaken the consultation or the value-setting process. This goes back to our case that this is purely an interim plan change. The NPSFM 2020 must be given effect to in the new land and water regional plan. The timeframe suggested by Council for that plan to be developed enable value-setting consultation to occur. And we note that consistency issues may arise between the yet-to-be-notified RPS and Plan Change 7. However, as suggested in the legal submissions of the Regional Council on the matter, parties should be given the opportunity to submit on the effect of the RPS on this plan change if it is notified prior to the court making a decision on Plan Change 7. And we would support that process. HortNZ consider that the interim nature of Plan Change 7 and the development of the new land and water regional plan and the timeframes it suggests is an appropriate pathway towards giving effect to the NPSFM 2020. So, as you know, Your Honour, at paragraph 22, there have been substantial changes to the provisions of Plan Change 7 through this hearing process, culminating in the 8 April version. HortNZ considered the changes that were recommended in the 14th of March version and decided that supplementary planning evidence was not required at that stage, as the planning conferencing had already been scheduled for the 8th and 9th of April. However, the court requested an updated brief of evidence from Mr. Hodson, and this was lodged on Tuesday, 13th of April. In Mr. Hodson's updated evidence, he records his support of the cascade of activity rules as drafted in the 8 April version, and while that version also includes changes regarding community water supply and hydroelectricity generation, which he does not comment on, HortNZ's position before the court today is that that version of PC7, as recorded at the planning conferencing, resolves HortNZ's concerns.
Now, you will have heard us quiz the last planning witness about some of the content of that document, and I imagine Mr. Moore might also have questions as well. So while you may be happy, I suspect some finessing the Regional Council will certainly say there's some finessing that needs to be done.
Yes.
Yeah, and so we'll probably take the same approach with your witness.
Yes, of course, Your Honour. I guess the cascade of the activity rules there is what's important to HortNZ. It's, as I've already noted, it's really important to for our growers to have a pathway to go through if they don't fit the controlled or the restricted discretionary activity. So that non-complying door does need to be open, even if it is a very tight door to get through.
Yes, you might have heard the transcript talk about the narrow or wide door and or gate. So actually that non-complying rule is something that's very much in play.
Yes.
I don't know. The fact that it is included in this JWS, I don't know, means that all the planners signed up to it. In fact, I rather think they had... It was beyond the scope of the conference. They were editing back changes, yes, if you like, as a consequence of the schedule. So
yes,
as schedule meant, had to do some edits in some of the policies and rules. But I don't think that necessarily follows. They all loved the non-complying activity pathway, because I don't think that would not be the tenor of... cross-examination. So just saying that, yeah.
Yes,
but you might love it, and if you love it, you can say it's a narrow door and you're really happy with that narrow door.
I wouldn't necessarily say that we're really happy with it.
Yeah.
I will leave those detailed questions to Mr. Hodson.
Yeah, okay.
But as long as that pathway is open, Hort can work within the time frame, because this is purely just that transitional interim planning framework.
Yeah. No one's asking any longer that I'm aware, and you know, we've obviously got quite a few parties to come, but I'm not aware of anyone still continuing to ask for a prohibited activity status.
Which is great.
Good. Okay.
I would just like to talk through the pathways that were provided in that 8 April version. And as Mr. Hodson's updated evidence talked through in a bit more detail. So we support the cascade of activity rules of a controlled activity, the RDA, and a non-complying activity. The 8 April version retains the stripped-back interim consenting framework that was recommended in the 14 March version, but provides a clear pathway for applicants to demonstrate that the effects of their non-complying activity will be no more than minor, as per the first limb of the 104 gateway test. Just as a side note there, Your Honour, Mr. Webb tomorrow will be able to speak to this, as we think that his orchard has, and you will see it in the site visits as well, provides quite a good example of where that non-complying activity might be appropriate.
Oh, that'll be great. Okay.
So just to flag that with you.
Because I think part of the difficulty with a non-complying pathway is that nobody can imagine what that looks like.
Yes.
Yeah, it's trying to conjure up applications out of thin air. So the fact that Mr. Webb's got something in mind, I think, is really helpful. Yeah.
For horticulture, it is particularly relevant because of the planning that goes into that expansion. And for Mr. Webb, you'll be able to question him and have the conversation with him in a lot more detail. But as I understand it, if orchardists need to put a deposit on trees 2 or 3 years prior to them being planted. And so the development that's happening at his orchard at the moment was planned and in place 2 years ago, prior to the notification of this. And he had trees go in September last year, I think, which is past the cut-off date of March 2020 for that, what's in the plan at the moment. But he didn't really have an option because those were paid for 2 years ago. And so it's that expansion there that we think might fit within that non-complying activity rule. And so, yeah, something to traverse with Mr. Webb and Mr. Hodson as well.
Thank you.
So the controlled activity at paragraph 26 uses the period 1 September 2017 to 18th March 2020 as the baseline of total land area under irrigation under the controlled activity conditions. This has addressed Hort NZ's concerns that the growers who had improved or expanded their irrigation system and or other infrastructure since 2017 as per the date in the notified version would not be faced with the financial cost of reconsenting and all that sort of thing, Your Honour. The restricted discretionary activity is an extension of the controlled activity and provides a pathway for growers where a calculation in accordance with Schedule 10A.4 might not be possible. The restricted discretionary activity enables growers to prove historical use of water, and the Council is able to consider that information in terms of its accuracy and validity. In essence, it is only the method of calculation that is varied between the controlled and restricted discretionary activities, the effect of which is that the controlled activity will still likely be encouraged in the preferred consent pathway that growers apply for.
Just pause there a second, I just want to reread that. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
The non-complying activity enables an applicant to advance a case for a longer-term consent or irrigation expansion if the effects of the activity are no more than minor, as per the first limb of the Section 104 gateway test. The avoid policy recommended by Mr. DePausmaker in the 14th March version closes the door to a policy argument under Section 104D. This is appropriate in the context of the interim nature of the plan change, as it provides options to growers where it is appropriate, but does not encourage the use of the non-complying activity. This cascade of activities is recommended in the 8 April version, which HoreNZ supports.
So there may be a merits-based assessment as a non-complying activity. Which activity, and again, you'd have to get the four corners right, but the example, I'm not sure whether your four corners are exactly what Mr. Webb's circumstances are, that irrigation's in ground, or, you know, earthworks together with irrigation systems have already been rolled out. And in that particular case, plants purchased and planted. But there's a merits-based assessment, and that assessment would look to presumably the increase in volume, if there is an increase in volume of water based on historical use, together with questions over any effect, well, maybe questions over any effect on the environment as a consequence of the expansion of the area. The obvious example being nutrients, but, you know, maybe, I don't know whether that's obvious or not, because I don't know what other chemicals are brought to bear on, you know, within horticulture and how, and the regulation of those and any change in scale, intensity, with, you know, the volume and concentration of those.
Yes, right.
So that's the gateway that you want. It's yes. Got the those two potential effects.
Yes, I think I understand your question.
So that you, through the non-complying gateway, you could potentially increase the volume of water, so we're no longer using an historical
yes.
volume, and you could potentially increase or change the concentration or load of contaminants. That they would be the two main changes?
Potentially, yes.
Potentially. So then how does the plan change speak to that would be the would be what the court would want to know, particularly in the context of the policy and the objective.
Mr. Hodson might be able to answer a little bit more fully, but my understanding is that through that non-complying door pathway, the policy door is shut, so because it's not, there's the avoid policy in there. But if an applicant can show that the effects of their activity that they've applied for is no more than minor, then they might be able to continue with that activity for potentially an increased area of irrigation or a change in the volume of water that's used, which could potentially go the other way as well as irrigation systems are improved and efficiency is improved as well. So I guess it's being able to have that pathway open to show that merits-based, no more than minor effects are there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's going to be the challenge for yours?
Yes.
Yep, okay.
Gotcha. We do accept that that is quite a tight door.
Seems to be very narrow
indeed. And so if it was opened, I think, there is still a wee bit of work to do there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So just to conclude, Your Honour, when HoreNZ made a submission and further submission on Plan Change 7, which sought a viable and efficient consenting pathway for horticultural growers in the region. HortNZ considers that the 8 April version of the plan change resolves its issues it raised in submissions, and this version effectively and efficiently provides an interim plan change which enables a just transition period for water users in the Otago region, obviously still with that work that is to be canvassed.
Okay, very good. So your first witness. Oh, does anyone got any, have you got any questions, commissioners?
Thank you. Very clear.
Very clear.
Well done. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes. Ms. Moore has a question.
We exhausted my supply of questions. One matter I've been contemplating seeking leave from the court relates to whether I might question some of the lay farming submitters on the question of whether they can describe the irrigable area that they had in play between 2017 and 2020, given that issue was made live by Ms. Dicey. I've been extremely reluctant to not cross-examining lay witnesses, and if the court's going to be exploring that question amongst its questions for those witnesses, I won't need to do so. But it does appear to be a live issue.
I don't, in principle, because of the importance of the issue, and also because actually farmers are the best people placed to talk about this stuff, not anybody else. I don't have any problems in principle with you asking questions about it. Do you?
I can't speak for the witnesses themselves.
No.
But in principle, no. We agree that the growers are the best people to talk to this issue. Because they know the land, they know what they're doing on it.
They know the farm. Farming systems.
Yeah, and you experts.
Everybody would have sat and listened to the highly theoretical debate happening with experts, but actually, and farmers are the people who are expert in farming systems. And I think it would be of benefit to the court, and I think of benefit to the regional council that we can, just test, is there really a problem here, or is there no problem here? And so if you're happy,
I'll grant that we'd be happy with that, Your Honour, and just reiterate that our growers really do just want to have a conversation so that their message is clear and gets across.
Good. Okay, thank you. All right, so I think you want to call, was it
Mr. Weaver?
Weaver, yeah, okay, just go to the right volume. Mr. Weaver is going to be making a statement. Okay.
Do you swear by Almighty God that the evidence you're about to make of this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Mr. Weaver, just so you know, this is very much the same, similar sort of process as what Ms. Ma went through this morning and this afternoon. Hopefully a little bit narrow, not as long. but this is your opportunity to present your evidence and to tell the court, present to the court what you're here to present for. So I've got a couple of questions just to start off with. Can you confirm that your full name is Ernst Weaver?
Correct.
And you're a director of Leaning Brock Cherries?
Yes, I am.
And you made a statement of evidence dated 5th of February 2021?
Correct.
And you've got a one-page summary?
Yes, I have a one-page summary.
Do you have any corrections to make to your statement?
Yes, in paragraph 10, there's a typo where it says lead rather than leaf. I think it could misconstrue something if we didn't deal with that.
This is paragraph 10 to your original submission. Is that right? Yep, okay.
So that should read, this includes tensiometer readings, soil moisture readings, soil and leaf testing, and using data from weather stations.
Correct.
I see why you'd want to change that.
Beg your pardon?
I can see why you'd want to change that.
Yeah, it makes a difference.
And you've got the experience and knowledge of the industry as set out in your original statement at paragraphs 3 to 5.
Yes, correct.
Great. This is, as I said before, your chance. So if you'd like to start with your one-page summary, I'll have no further questions and then we'll leave it up to the court.
Thank you. Okay. My name is Ernst Weaver. I'm a director of Leaning Rock Cherries Limited. We made a submission on proposed Plan Change 7 and support the submission of Horticultural New Zealand. I'm also speaking on behalf of Peter Morrison, who is a neighbouring orchardist. Leaning Rock Cherries Limited grows a variety of stone fruit, also known as summer fruit, and pip fruit in the Manuhirikia catchment. We produce approximately 18 to 20 tonnes of cherries per hectare, 57 tonnes each of peaches and nectarines, 30 tonnes of apricots, and 70 tonne of apples per hectare. The operation is a total of 64 hectares, most of which is irrigated. For the past 35 years, we've been operating Leaning Rock Cherry, supported by a water supply agreement signed originally with the Crown, then with the Manuhirikia Irrigation Cooperative Society Limited. Our association with the irrigation scheme and access to a defined water quota has become the norm for us. For the last 35 years, we've operated with a take allocation of 5.8 millimetres per hectare per day. We've improved our operating systems in that time and grow all our fruit in accordance with best practice. We're continually learning and developing our management practice to improve our sustainability as much as we can. This includes tensiometer reading, soil moisture reading, soil and leaf testing, and using data from weather stations to form our irrigation decisions. We also conduct fruit diameter testing and only irrigate what we have to. Now, if I could just add into there, it's not just about the triggers for the irrigation, it's also about the management of the irrigation system, in that we irrigate in the evening with all our micro sprinklers and any overhead that we may do. Our drip line irrigation, or not so much drip line, but some of our micro sprinkler irrigation, we pulse to make sure that we don't over irrigate with it. And pulsing, I mean that we may run for to put 2 mils on, and then 3 or 4 hours later another 2 mils, and then another 2 mils later on after that. And it's about getting the best use out of that water. In order for our growing operation to continue, we need certainty that the water supply we rely on will be available to us. We need PC7 to enable us to keep using this water allocation. And in Appendix 1 attached to my statement of evidence describes the negative impact of tree water deprivation. And in there I talk about the consequence if the tree is short of water. And must say that some of those consequences also come about if the tree is over-irrigated, and particularly in soft fruit. So the negative impact of underwatering is equally can be an overwatering. So we've got to be on the knocker as much as what we can to make sure that our fruit quality is right. And if it's not, there's no real second base, particularly if we're doing an export, cherry export apricot, that there is no second base for that fruit, that if it fails, if the fruit doesn't size, if it's too soft, there's no ability to make a profit at that point. So we need to have it right. We also need PC7 to provide flexibility for different types of growing systems and now allow us to use water for irrigation and frostbiting. If we cannot, then we will not be able to maintain export or New Zealand grade quality crops, and this will result in significant loss of profits and ultimately job losses. We would be forced to cease operation and sell out. I'm concerned that PC7 will not enable us to take the amount of water that we need when we need it to be able to sustainably operate our horticultural business. This would be hugely detrimental to the trees, plants, environment and people that make up the fruit growing business. Thank you.
Now, can I just ask you again, because I didn't quite catch it, the paragraph that you needed to amend from lead to leaf?
Yes.
Which number was that?
Paragraph 10.
Paragraph 10. Okay, and is this in your brief of evidence or is this in the original submission?
In the original.
Okay. Right. I'll get you to indicate which document and what paragraph because I can't.
So that's in the statement of evidence?
Yeah, got that.
And page 3?
Page 3.
10.
And my paragraph 10 starts by way of background. Oh, God, sorry, looking at the wrong witness, no wonder. Sorry. I'm with you. Paragraph 10. Oh, I've got it right.
Yeah, sword and leaf.
I just have to get that my record right for the court's record. So it's important that I locate it. Very good. All right. Okay, so Mr. Moore has some questions for you. He's endeavouring to draw out your years of experience as an irrigator, just so that we have a firmer factual basis upon which to make decisions, because we're not there yet, but largely because we actually haven't heard from individual farmers yet, I suspect. So Mr. Moore has some questions for you, and the court may do as well.
Thank you, and good afternoon. I'm very keen to understand the irrigation system that you use on your property, and I wonder whether you can help me with my understanding. So do you recall when the irrigation system was first put in?
I became a director of the company about 10 years ago, so no. I do know, because I was involved with, I knew the family well that was putting it in. So what initially went in was a under-tree micro-sprinkler system in the original plantings.
And roughly when might that have been?
That would have been early 90s, I think.
Right. And then your more recent involvement has been over the past 10 years?
I think it's 10 years, maybe a few more, yeah.
And over that period of time, there's been some development of the orchard, as you've set out in your evidence?
Yeah.
And in terms of that irrigation system, the development of the system's occurred as the orchard has expanded?
Yes.
And when you've expanded at each stage, and as I read your evidence, there have been sort of 5-hectare increments in terms of expansion. And I want you to think about the irrigation system itself. Has the system itself changed in relation to the existing parts of the orchard as you roll out into the new 5 hectares?
Generally not. The existing orchard's been left in the way it was, and the new blocks have been introduced with different irrigation systems, application systems.
And as each step by way of development occurs, you'd be looking at finding the most efficient types of irrigation systems to use the water that's available?
Yeah, correct. And sometimes there's a sort of a you've got to balance that with frost protection as well. And in cases we may leave in micro sprinklers rather than drip line, or it's a consideration to leave in micro sprinklers that will be able to help with some frost protection as opposed to drip line where it has no gain for frost.
So in the context of drip line, if you are looking to add frost protection, you'd have to put some overhead sprinkler type system in?
No, we've gone for frost fans, wind machines.
Right.
And then the micro sprinkler supplies a little bit of heat underneath, so you get about a 1 degree lift.
Right, now that's helpful. So when you think about the development of the orchard and you understand where your orchard is it fair to say that you'd have a clear understanding of the parts of your orchard that are under irrigation from time to time?
In what way? Just rephrase that for me.
You'll know precisely the location of your irrigation system in an orchard.
Yeah, yes.
It's pretty obvious in the sense that the irrigation system will follow where the trees are.
Yeah, yeah, align directly.
And if I ask you to cast your mind back to 2017, you could tell me precisely where you had trees and irrigation in place at the time?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
And the same would apply 2018 and 2019?
Yeah, I guess.
And if I asked you to draw on a map for me the maximum area irrigated between 1 July 2018 20. Let me get my dates right. September 2017 to 18 March 2020. If I gave you a map of your property, you'd be able to shade for me the areas under irrigation, the maximum area during that period of time.
Yeah, pretty much, but if I couldn't do it, the orchard manager sure as hell could. Yeah.
The orchard manager sure as hell could.
Oh, OK, thank you. That's right.
Yeah, so in the context of an orchard operation, that would not be an onerous task.
No.
And in your evidence, your paragraph 17, you had explained to me, or explained in your evidence for the court's benefit, the challenges that your orchard was facing with having had a fixed date. In the notified version of Plan Change 7, which was the maximum amount of irrigable area in the 2017-2018 period of time, because you'd done some expansion after that date. The council planner has recommended that a change be made to extend that period of time through to the 18th of March 2020. And would that extension through to that date capture the increases that you have undertaken?
It's just the bulk of it. Yes, because the last plantings are only 2 years old. Yep.
Very good. Those are my questions. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions?
How do you rate the way you manage your operation?
How do I rate it?
Compared with others. Is yours a sort of a model to follow, or?
Well, I work as a horticulture consultant out there, so I think the monitoring and the work that goes on there to make sure that the water is right and the applications are right is right up there, top of the class. It's a difficult site with some of the soils, with the permeability of the soils and the ability to get the water moving into the soil. But one of the key things that the manager's implemented, he has tensiometers sitting at 600 mil below the root zone, making sure that that doesn't get flooded. And that's sort of, so that's the catch-all at the finish. If we've got some of the calcs wrong on the, so we work off the evapotranspiration rates and the coefficients that go, that change as you go through the season with the growth curve. But if we were to over-irrigate, we'd pick that up with the technology that's sitting there. So it's pretty good.
And is that a reasonably common approach with other?
Oh, there's others doing that, yes. The thing is that with fruit, if we don't get that right and we over-irrigate, we've got a poor piece of fruit. And there's no future in that. And we over-irrigate, we get excess growth, we get soft fruit, we get problems that soft fruit leads to more, aphids become, or soft growth as aphids, and there's all sorts of downsides if we over-irrigate. Under-irrigate's got exactly the same. Small fruit, soft fruit, poor stems on cherries. So there's no... We're looking for that sweet spot all the time.
So it's imperative for the success of the business to do it right.
Yeah, to manage the water well.
Yeah.
Yes. Amongst everything else that's going on, of course, but that's just one of those challenges that we have. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Your Honour.
So I picked up that you're a shareholder with the Manahere Care Irrigation Company, and it's from them that you get your water?
Yes.
And so you're not a permit holder yourself, a water permit holder?
No. We our water is via the irrigation company.
Okay.
Yeah.
In terms of the people that you consult to, are any of them holding DEEM permits?
Individually.
Individually, yeah.
No, don't think so.
Okay.
No.
Now, forgive my ignorance, but in your orchard, are you using fertilisers or other agrochemicals within the orchard itself?
Yes, yeah. For sure, yeah.
And with the agrochemicals, are they, is the quantum that you apply fixed by any regulation in this country?
I think all orchards are working under NZGAP or Eurogap, so good agricultural practice, mm-hmm. which means every input has to be justified and measured.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if we think about the pest and disease program,
yeah.
it's about targeting the pest and disease and finding the softest option to do that. So you understand the life cycle, you understand where it is best to intervene in that life cycle to take care of the pest.
And in the justification of the use of agrochemicals and their measurement, is that to a regulator or is the requirement there that you keep your own record?
You keep your own records,
yes.
But at the same time, or the fruit, your spray program goes in front of the in this case, your quality to assess if you've met the requirements of withholding periods and put up samples for residue testing, so
yeah.
is that you've got fruit as meeting those. Those requirements are those chemicals that have been used.
Mm.
So that GAP requirement is audited as well, externally audited.
Mm. And it may not be, or it may or may not be an issue for the Regional Council, I don't know. In terms of people that are in your category, so people who have in-ground irrigation systems, so you've expanded your irrigation area and you've put into place the irrigation system itself, whether the discharge of agrochemicals is of concern to them. Can you comment about any work that the Regional Council has done in this area, or no work in terms of monitoring the effects of use of those sprays on waterways?
I'm not aware of any
not
work that's been done at that.
Okay.
No.
All right. All right, well, there are questions. Have you got any follow-up questions?
No, Your Honour.
No? There are not many but it's that you have been actually really helpful, so thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Weaver.
Okay.
We would like to call Mr. Stuart Ford.
Yep.
Mr. Ford, can you please confirm that your full name is Stuart John Ford?
That's correct.
And you prepared a statement of evidence in chief dated 5th of February 2021?
That's correct.
Do you have any corrections to make to that statement?
No, I don't.
Can you confirm that your statement is true and correct?
Yes, I can.
And do you have the experience and qualifications set out in paragraph 6 of your statement?
Yes, I do.
And have you prepared a summary of your statement to read?
I haven't prepared a summary, but I'd like to speak to a brief summary. That's
yes.
Okay.
Yes, of course. Can you read that now and then we'll move into questions?
Okay.
Thank you.
My evidence in chief that was prepared before you was initially as a result of reading the Section 32 report on the Plan Change 7. And it's my opinion that the matters of economic interest in it, which includes choosing the appropriate method, cost and benefits of the method, the effectiveness and efficiency evaluations, and particularly the two elements of considering its impact on future growth and its impact on employment, were pretty scarce in terms of their justification or explaining their reasons for coming to the conclusions. So when you look at my evidence in terms of the vegetable sector, it's pretty static, and it's not expanding at all. But it's got very efficient irrigation systems. So I don't see any problems with the vegetable sector in terms of that. But when you look at my evidence in terms of the fruit sector, both the summer fruit industry is expanding at a tremendous rate, and the pit fruit industry is also expanding at about 10%. So in terms of considering its impact on future growth or employment, I felt that PC7 was quite inadequate. So then if you look at Rule 10A3.1.1.1, as I say in my evidence, it's a very blunt instrument to achieve the aims of what it was trying to do. And that's from the perspective of allowing for future growth and allowing for future employment. So the pathway I would describe as a roadblock. There wasn't a pathway for horticulture to move through that satisfactorily. So I'm very pleased that the planning process has achieved a pathway, and admittedly, and I guess my major concerns are in terms of the ability to expand the area, and I've said in my evidence that there may be situations where areas can be expanded with no negative impacts. So that's I think it's a satisfactory resolution of that. Admittedly, the pathway at the top is very narrow, but at least it gives us the opportunity to expand the area or expand the take of water. So from an efficiency perspective, I'm very pleased with where this process has got to, and that negates a lot of what was in my evidence in chief.
Understood. Mm-hmm. So we'll just see if Mr. Moore's got any questions.
Moore does have some questions.
Right.
Thank you. Now, I appreciate things have moved as they do with lengthy hearings like this, and it's some time ago that you put pen to paper in terms of your evidence in chief. So where your thinking has evolved past that which is recorded here, please feel free to share your refreshed opinion as we work through the opinions expressed in your evidence.
Okay.
The first topic that I do want to explore with you is the topic around to give you a reference, paragraph 15 in your evidence in chief. And this relates to the reliability of supply of water to justify substantial or significant levels of investment.
Yes.
Now, when you think about the horticultural sector and you think about the opinion you've expressed in your paragraph 15, what length of time do you have in mind as being the length of time where there needs to be sufficient quantity of water and reliability of supply of water to justify the substantial investments you refer to in that paragraph?
It's very hard for me to be exact on it, but you learnt from Mr. Weaver that the investments are long term in terms of the development of fruit particularly, and so the payback is quite a long period. So I would think at least 15 years would be the minimum in terms of ensuring security of the consent.
So when you think about...
And it's maybe not only that term, but it's the ability for it to roll over, which is important.
Now, you do provide some evidence about the ability to roll over later in your evidence, so hold that thought and we will get there in the fullness of time. But you're... broadly speaking, saying a 15-year window is the window that you have in mind when you're thinking about this type of a period.
A minimum period, yeah.
So when you think about the current state of play in Otago, you have an understanding that the deemed permits are all due to expire on the 1st of October of this year?
Yes, I am.
So when you cast your mind back and look at investment decisions that are made and have been made, say, in the last five-year period, those decisions will have been made knowing that the duration on the existing permits only had a five-year period of time to run?
That's correct.
And so when you think about the risks associated with that, would you accept that in that context, the irrigator is taking a risk in terms of whether the permit might be renewed in the future?
I'm not sure whether there would be any doubt that it would be renewed. It would just be in terms of what terms it would be renewed on.
Well, in your experience, is there an expectation that permits will be renewed?
I think you would have to ask the growers that more specifically, but I would expect so.
So from when you're thinking about things from an economic perspective, how do you price in the risks associated with consent renewal?
Again, it depends on the risk profile of the individual. And I think it depends on where the investment is coming from. If it's coming from the individual grower, They may be more risk averse, but if a lot of it's being funded by banks and things like that, the risk assessment is usually done by the financier.
Now, do you have an understanding in relation to Plan Change 7 that short-term rollover consents are proposed?
Yes.
And the time period for those consents, you understand, is a six-year period?
Yes, that's correct.
And when you think about that six-year period and you contrast that to the 15-year period of investment certainty required in relation to reliability of supply of water, etc., you wouldn't get that certainty over the six-year period?
That's correct.
And so if one of the purposes of Plan Change 7 is to discourage investment in irrigation expansion, and one of its tools is a six-year consent period, it would in fact achieve that outcome, wouldn't it?
It would, but I'd question why that was the aim of this legislation.
Now, when you Now tell me if we're straying beyond your area of expertise. Do you have an understanding of the current status of allocation of resources in the Otago region?
No, I do not, and that's outside my expertise.
If you were to assume then for the time being that the water resources in the Otago region may be significantly over allocated, and that the council over the next 6-year period is preparing a new land and water plan to address the effects of that over allocation, it may well be that there is insufficient water for existing activities at that point in time.
That's correct.
And so if that is indeed the case, then isn't it better to send a signal now that investment in further irrigation requiring additional infrastructure and additional water should be held off?
I'm not convinced that it's the council's role to make that signal, and that's why I like the non-compliant activity rule in this one, because then the applicant can prove that all of those things are less than minor and can proceed.
Well, we seem to be straying at that point perhaps into the planning realm, so I want you to stay in the realm of dealing with the risk of investment decisions.
Okay.
So is it better to know now that there might not be water for new and expensive irrigation infrastructure, or is it better to know in 6 years' time after the investment has been made that there might not be water?
I think an individual farmer's decision would be based on his knowledge of the amount of water available in his catchment or his area.
Well, if we look at the current state of affairs, there has been, it would appear, investment in irrigation expansion in circumstances where permits had only, say, 1 or 2 years to roll.
That may well be correct.
And so here the council is trying to send a signal that great care needs to be taken in terms of investment in assets which might require a security of supply of water into the medium term, when that water supply might not be available in the short term.
That may be correct.
I want to move through to your paragraph 36.
Yes.
And in that paragraph you set out an opinion in relation to what you consider to be an unfair economic burden on an irrigator associated with 6-year consent durations.
That's correct.
When you're thinking about this from an economic perspective, do you view water as a commodity in this context?
Yes, I do.
And when you're expressing your economic opinion, you have not addressed the environmental burden that is associated with the allocation of water?
Yes, it's part of the resource consideration.
So where in your evidence have you assessed the environmental impact of longer-term consents?
I state in several cases that I think, depending on the environmental and economic performance, they should be granted. Yeah, paragraph 39, in my opinion, a 15-year consent that has rights to renew, given the requirement to meet the flow and quality requirements of the water source first, would be needed at a minimum to provide appropriate security to the sector.
So prior to granting a 15-year consent, it would be important to understand the necessary flow and quality requirements that are necessary to sustain environmental values?
That's what I'm saying, yes.
So until that's known, a great care should be taken before issuing longer-term consents, so 15 years.
Yes, that's correct.
To take you to your paragraph 49 now, and this paragraph is in that part of your evidence when you are referring to the restriction on expansion of irrigation area.
Yep.
And you will have heard from my questions perhaps this morning that the plan change has moved on to increase the window within which the maximum irrigable area is to be calculated. So it's now covering a period of time from September 2017 to March 2020.
That's correct.
But notwithstanding that change, do you still express an opinion that there is potential for a quite large negative economic impact associated with restricting irrigation expansion?
Sorry, state that again.
Do you maintain your opinion that there is still, in your words, quite large negative economic impacts from restricting irrigation expansion?
Yes, I do.
Might there also be significant negative economic impacts associated with stranded irrigation infrastructure if, in 6 years' time, there is insufficient water available to reliably operate that infrastructure?
Yes, there would be, and that's why I'm encouraging of the non-compliant regime to handle applications which wish to increase the area or the amount of water taken.
Now, I'm going to pick up the non-compliant, as you say, pathway with your planner, unless you're wanting to get into the planning realm.
No, I do
no,
not.
I didn't think so. Thank you, Mr. Ford. Thank you, Your Honour.
Re-examination. Have you got any questions?
I only had the one question, and it's arisen out of Mr. Moore asking you a question. So I realised that I didn't fully understand your evidence. Paragraph 44. So you start out by talking about 15-year consent, and then you say that has rights to renew. So I want to understand what you mean by that. Do you have a time period in mind for rights to renew?
So where's this? Paragraph?
In your paragraph 44?
Yes.
Looking at the first line, you talk about 15-year consent that has rights to renew. Now, I might go on and ask you a bit more about the second sentence, but in relation to the first sentence, what do you mean by rights to renew?
Can you read out the beginning of the sentence?
Sorry, have you got a different version?
I hope not.
Yeah.
I've got 44.
44 starts with me at paragraphs 37 and 38. Is that the same as you, Mr. Ford?
Yes.
Yes. And what's your paragraph start?
It starts, in my opinion, a 50-year... a 15-year consent that has rights to renew, which is the what I've written down that Mr. Moore has 44, as I do.
No, it's paragraph 39.
Oh, OK. Oh, I see. Well, I don't quite...
Oh, that's confusing.
I don't quite understand that. Mine, certainly, out of my folder, is 44. Okay. But it seems like it might say the same thing as 39, so yes. Nothing hinges on that if I can continue with my question.
As long as we're all looking at the same paragraph.
Perhaps I could just read out the sentence and you can tell me if that's what you're looking at under some other paragraph number. In my opinion, a 15-year consent that has rights to renew, given the requirement to meet the flow and quality requirements of the water source first, would be needed at a minimum to provide appropriate security to the sector.
Okay. So what I'm talking about that is a consent having almost automatic rights of renewal when it comes to an end. So that would be a 15-year consent that has almost automatic rights of renewal at the end.
What, another 15 years and 15 years beyond and 15 years beyond
that? Subject to the planning regime that it was in at the time.
But the planning regime might have to remain static if you are going to have the same thing approved every 15 years. Because the flow and quality requirements may in fact require a lowering, for example, of the take. So when you wrote this, did you mean that the 15-year consent needed to basically have the same ability to take and apply the water?
It was more to do with my comment in 36A. First of all, the consent should be granted for a much longer term with the appropriate condition that if anything changes as a result of changes to the water and planning regime, the consent is subject to those changes. So it's not a constant thing. It's renewed according to the planning regime at the time.
Oh, I see. So I'm going up to what I have as paragraph 41.
Oh, okay,
a renewal of a consent shall be automatic,
subject
to the applicant proving that they continue to meet all the requirements of the consent.
I think in that context, what I'm talking about in my 39 is 36A, which is your
41. So the first part of that is a longer term with a condition if there's a change to the water planning regime, then the consent should be subject to that.
Yes.
So it's not... Yeah, okay. So if looking at 44, I thought you just meant that you had to keep...
No,
you were saying things could change.
Most consents now have conditions in them that if the water and planning regime changes, the consent conditions change.
Right, so you're accepting of a review.
Yes, very much so, yeah.
But in that regard, though, you would still be thinking that there would be water there.
Yes.
Yeah. Not that you might turn the tap off completely.
Yes.
Is that the point?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Sorry about all that confusion. No, I don't know why mine's got different numbers.
Afraid it will give you, well, I think it's the copy. Okay. Commissioner, have you got a question?
I don't think so. Thank you, sir. I mean...
I have no questions. So, anything arising from Commissioner's questions? None? Okay. Well, thank you very much,
Mr. Paul,
for your evidence. Right. Your next witness?
Yes, Ms. Michelle Sands.
Yep.
Thank you.
swear by Almighty God that the evidence you're about to give to this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Can you confirm your full name is Michelle Kathleen Sands?
Yes, that's right.
And you've prepared a statement of evidence of chief dated 5 February 2021?
Yes.
Do you have any corrections to make?
Yes, I have one. In paragraph 29, the number, in the first sentence, the number 297 hectares should read 267.
Other than that correction, can you confirm that your statement is true and correct?
Yes.
In light of things having moved on since you wrote this in February, I've just got a couple of questions, mm-hmm. and then we can move into a summary.
Okay.
Is that all right? Mm-hmm. Firstly, can you just explain where Hort started in this proceedings and where we've gotten to now as the industry person?
Sure. So I think there's probably four main elements that we have been considering. So the first is around the duration of the renewal consent. And initially in our submission, we were opposed to the short duration. But on reflection and in evidence, we accepted that. And the reason for that was in light of the MPSFM and in light of the over-allocated nature of some of the catchments in Otago. And so what this plan change can't do is speak to the freshwater values that are to come. And also in the context of over-allocated catchments, we think, the relative values and benefits of activities on land. And so for horticulture, some of the things that we particularly value is the value of domestic food supply, which Otago is important for, and we consider to be a second priority under the Tamana o Tawai framework, and that can't be provided for in this plan. And another matter that can't be provided for in this plan, but in the next can be, is the Climate Change Commission's budget. And so horticulture has lesser greenhouse gas emissions than other activities that would use the same amount of water. So I suppose where I'm heading to is that we're aware that if water was to be locked up by other users and there was to be clawback into the future, it may not be able to provide for values that are important to growers as well as important to the environment. So that's the reason why we've shifted on that point. The next point is really around that date. The next point I'm going to talk about, the point that we've shifted on, is the calculation method. So this was probably our primary concern in our evidence, was around that if we are going to get a renewal, it's really important that, and it's a short renewal, it's just really important that the amount of water is the right amount of water for them to carry on doing their activity. And so we were concerned about the calculation method in the notified version, that it would not or may not provide the necessary amount of water for the existing activity. Now, our expert, Mr. McIndoe, was satisfied through that conferencing that the controlled method, calculation method, now is much better, and then also we think it's really important that the RDA provides a pathway for those people that can't meet that calculation method. So we are now satisfied that that addresses that issue, although I would say in our submission we spoke about reasonable use tests, and we still maintain that that's really important, that ultimately and in the coming plan, that when the amount of water that is to be allocated to people, that it passes a test of reasonable use rather than just historic use. But we accept in the context of this plan, the approach proposed now is acceptable. The other matter is around the date. So the date for the date for the expanded irrigation area. And so, as Bean has said by Mr. Ford, you know, and others, there is a long lead-in time for purchasing or, you know, planning ahead for purchase tree crops. And so there definitely are people who have expanded since that 2017 date. There are still some that have expanded past the 2020 date as well that we're aware of. And, in fact, you can speak to our witness, Mr. Webb, about that. But we think, you know, if you need, you kind of do need a date, I think, in the plan. And it's hard to think of a better date than the notified date, I think. And so then that leaves us with that non-complying pathway, which we sought originally, and we still maintain is very important that it is a real pathway for people who can demonstrate that their effects are less than minor, which we think is possible for horticultural expansion in some catchments due to its limited water quality effects, efficient water use, and in some catchments which aren't over allocated, that minor effects could be demonstrated.
Apologies, Your Honour, I should have confirmed Ms. Sands's experience prior to that original question. So I just want to confirm that you're the manager of natural resources at Horticulture New Zealand.
Yes, I am.
And you're providing industry experience,
yes.
Evidence. As part of that evidence, can you just expand a little bit on the auditing process and NZ Gap that Mr. Weaver touched on as well?
Yes. So, within the horticulture sector, all fruit and vegetables that are exported or sold to a New Zealand supermarket needs to be certified, and it is certified by the GAP programs. And those standards include standards which require growers to record fertiliser use and demonstrate good management practices around its use, and to agrochemicals also meet what's called a sort of GrowSafe, which is a standard around the use of agrochemicals, which enables them to meet the requirements of the Food Act and also to meet the requirements of the chemicals themselves, which are approved by the EPA to be used to get, you know, to meet certain standards. And so the GAP program outlines those standards, and then growers are independently audited. And if they fail the standard, they are not certified and they cannot sell their products. If they pass the standard, then they can be certified and sell their products. So it is a private standard, but it is also recognised in many regional plans, but not this one. So in many regional plans, for example, the GrowSafe requirements, which are mandated within the GAP program, are also reflected in regional plans to as a means of managing agrochemicals. So I suppose while we see in other regional plans regulatory requirements for farm planning or agrochemical management, and they may not be as clearly provided for in this region, the GAP standards are national and they are required to be met by all growers regardless of what the regional plan requires.
Great, thank you. I have no further questions, but can you please remain for any questions from my learned friends or the court?
All right, Mr. Moore.
Thank you. That was your summary, was it?
Yes.
Yes, very good.
Yeah.
I've got to take you to your paragraph 15 of your evidence in chief. I just want to make sure I've understood the basis on which you've provided evidence and are giving evidence to this court. You've recorded in your paragraph 15 that your role in this hearing is as Hort NZ's representative and advocate. And when I turn over the page to paragraph 17, I see there that you have recorded that you agree to abide by the expert witness code of conduct. and I'm left a little confused as to whether you're appearing as a representative, an advocate, or as an independent expert witness to assist the court. Can you assist me with that?
Yes, I'm as an advocate, not as an expert.
So it may well be that paragraph 17 had found its way into your evidence.
Yes, I believe that is the case.
So should I, for the record, should I just delete paragraph 17?
Yes, please do. Yes.
I want to take you to your paragraph 38. And this is the part of your evidence where you're dealing with six-year consent durations for renewals of water permits, and you expressed a position in that paragraph as to why a six-year expiry date is particularly problematic. And that refers, and the reason given there is in relation to the ability to secure capital. Mm-hmm. You'd accept that the current planning framework in the Otago region is in a state of flux at present, and that significant changes are likely to come in the new land and water plan, which will seek to give effect to the new national policy statement for freshwater management.
Yes.
And when you think about the signal that Plan Change 7 is, or one of the signals Plan Change 7 is seeking to send, it's one of sending the message of be really careful about investing in capital that might require a longer period of time to pay back, given that state of uncertainty.
Yes.
And having reflected on all of that, is that perhaps one of the reasons why the position of HortNZ has moved on in terms of the concerns that were initially expressed around the short duration for consents?
Yes, that's right, because we know that the NPSFM is coming and that there will have to be difficult allocation decisions made in some of these catchments, and that growers need to be aware of that. And if they feel confident or they can seek technical advice that provides them enough evidence that they can pass the non-complying pathway, they can do that in this plan. But I think that it isn't the right time to allow activities which could result in effects that are more than minor to occur in this period of time before those decisions around what the values are and what the limits need to be to achieve those values has been, that work has been done.
So in a sense, that reason for the six-year consent duration, and there are a number of reasons, but one of the reasons Mr. Palsmaker refers to is one of sending a signal not to invest in the interim. That message is coming through now clearly.
Yes.
Thank you. No further questions.
Re-examination. Okay. Are you any questions?
I just have the one question that I'm not clear about, having had a look at your planning witnesses' evidence, where basically he's adopted the joint witness statement from the planning people, and these two issues arise out of provisions that don't have any bubbles on the side saying more work's to be done on them. But I'm aware that not everybody necessarily agrees with the approach that's in this. Mm. And I'm not totally sure where your witness is sitting with it, because I'm going to have to question them tomorrow. But you're the representative, I notice, in terms of the discussion you've just had with Mr. Moore, so I do need some clarification on this. So I don't know whether you have the joint witness statement evidence or the statement, or in fact the better place to go might be the attachment to your planner's evidence at the back there. Do you have that? Attachment 1 to the planning JWS. Yeah. So perhaps if we could just go to the controlled activity. And, of course, that this very much interfaces with the calculation methodology that's been worked on in the schedule. But what you have in 1V, which is the rate of take, and V1 adopts the same approach in terms of the volumes, the daily, monthly and annual volume limits. You have these... you originally had this reference window, the period 1 July 2015 to 30 June 2020. And that's been struck out, and now there's just water years, any water years. And the other thing that's happened is we're not talking about averages or whatever, we're just talking about maximums. So potentially you could have situations where if you go back a long way, there might have been a lot of very inefficient border diking and wild flooding takes, and so that would mean that the historical use would be a very high at a very high level. And I'm just wondering where Port New Zealand sits on that in relation to all the things that you've said about the need to be looking ahead and thinking about what should happen in terms of the new plan, and not having a potentially a very high maximum calculator that people could then operate within in terms of this controlled activity and also the restricted discretionary activity.
Yes. I think, that's right. So one of the things about a long record from a hydrological perspective is to try and get that climatic variation, but of course you raise a really good point about the actual change in the system. Mm. I think one of the considerations is around the records that are acceptable for undertaking this calculation and whether or not ones that going back very far would meet the data standards in terms of, a reliable record of take. It may be that only data in more recent years has been collected at a standard that would enable the calculations as a consideration. But I do think that going back, I do think it's relevant, those kind of reasonable use tests are a consideration. But I think that this plan is supposed to be about rolling over historic rather than, planning for... that reasonable use test, which was what we originally sought, but now see that it has to come into a new plan. But in that respect, I think it wouldn't be unreasonable to have a start date.
A defined start and finish date. So did you have a view then on the 1st of July 2015 to the 30th of June 2020? Because you made quite a clear statement in terms of the irrigation area and the date.
To be honest, I think it's less like the 2020... When it comes to the expansion of the irrigation area, if that cannot, if that is into the non-complying activity, then I think that it matters less about the end date. I think you could have it not ending at 2020 because, if there's a drought year in the next couple of years, then that would be useful, reliable information to provide a understanding of what is a reasonable use. On the other hand, if the date was shut out at 2020 and there was a big drought, perhaps that could be a reason to go into the RDA. That would be a clear thing that you could demonstrate to a consents officer that for if the dates were 2015 to 2020, you could clearly say, yes, except that this weather was not representative of the long term, and now we can demonstrate that because the last couple of years has been quite different. So I think that it would be possible to put dates on it in the controlled pathway and then have the RDA open to make a case about those dates for whatever reason not being truly representative of your actual use, and that the test that you would have to pass within the RDA, or that discretion being around what you're actually doing and your irrigation
now,
scheme.
Not right back then.
Not right, yeah.
Or
right.
Into the future.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you for that.
Thinking about that, if the proposal is to increase the maximum use, that's not an RDA pathway, but your maximum use based on historical records. You know, so if you've got a future drought event, any proposal to take water which is in excess of your hitherto historical maximum would automatically put you in a non-complying route, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but the thing about droughts is that they're quite rare, so that's why usually in hydrology you want the longest record possible, because it might be really that you have to look back to the 1970s to find the drought that we're going to get next summer.
The supply's not being leveraged at to ensure reliability of supply in a drought event, though, is it?
Sorry, what was that?
You're not proposing that there's 100% reliability of supply.
No, but when you do, if you go to the way that quite frequently provisions are written in plans in terms of the amount of water that will be allocated to an individual person, it will be around, say, like a reasonable use with a 9 and 10 year reliability, something like that. Now, a 5 year duration period is unlikely to represent a 9 and 10 year reliability. I don't know if the period of 2020 to 2015 was representative of the average climate in the past or in the next 5 years, but usually you need a longer period to get it about right, you know, to get the maximum right for your dry year. So I think that is probably the logic that the hydrologists were adopting when they took the dates out, because that would be the normal way of thinking about, you know, trying to get that climatic variation.
So they were thinking about the hydrology, not about the system?
I wasn't there.
You were a hydrologist.
I'm imagining, because that's what I thought too. But you do raise a point about the system itself changing and I suppose becoming more efficient over time, and how to address that. If you were of a mind to put a date on it, like 2015, then I think that perhaps you could do that, but then the RDA pathway, I think you would need to leave that open for people to say that those 5 years aren't representative. Or maybe you'd need to check whether they were particularly wet or dry before you decided
Or if system change was your concern, then it's linking the rate intake and volume to existing systems, not historic systems.
Yeah.
And that would need some change, presumably, in the entry points, perhaps, to the RDA and controlled activity rule, or perhaps even a note in policy. But it's not to say that people ought to go. It's not driving efficient systems. It's just, you know, it's tying back historical use to current systems as opposed to systems which have been removed.
I suppose the issue there, from our perspective, is that, you know, part of accepting this 6 year duration is about a controlled activity pathway that is very simple, that is straightforward. And from a horticulture perspective, at least, and Mr. Weaver explained this, there is no, if you weren't expanding your area, which you are not allowed to do if that's non complying, then there is no particular advantage in using more water. You know, in fact, it's a disadvantage. You use the water efficiently in any case. So I'm not saying that's the case in every conceivable scenario. But that, you know, is where I think the horticulture sector would be sitting. They wouldn't necessarily be, they may be given a maximum, but if you couldn't expand beyond that.
It may well be that the horticulture system's not particularly inefficient in its use, but that can't be said for all farming systems, all farming sectors.
Yeah.
Don't know. Okay. All right.
Yes, and I suppose the question also becomes in terms of assessing that effect of the activity. If you were going into the non-complying pathway, you're assessing the effect of the... At that point, you're assessing the effect quite independently of...
My understanding of the non-complying pathway is that it's a merits-based assessment, but there's a policy, a very firm policy, still saying no more than 6 years. Is that your understanding?
No. I thought, and... Mr. Hodgson is probably the person to ask on this, but my expectation was that the non-complying pathway could be used for those that sought a consent duration longer than six years or consent
I don't think
area larger.
That's not the policy signal.
My understanding is that that means that you'd have to prove less than minor. You couldn't use that policy pillar, but you could use the other one, less than minor.
Yeah, my understanding, maybe I don't understand much, who knows, because the thing's changing all the time, but there's a very strong policy signal, no more than 6 years, even in a non-complying activity pathway. But if we are going non-complying, maybe it's an extra bit of area, maybe it's an extra bit of water, it's still a six-year signal. And so, you know, that actually might suit, is it Leaning Rock Cherries? Quite nicely, because they've got through most of the development. It's mostly in the ground up until 1 June 2020, and then a wee bit's gone in afterwards. And so for that wee bit, that actually it might be a neat solution for them, but still only 6 years. The wee bit is a wee bit more land, perhaps a wee bit more water, but still only 6 years. That's the pathway.
Yeah, so that's not...
your understanding.
Yeah, that's not... And so I suppose... my evidence and opinion is based on my understanding of that not being
the case. Well, let me just double-check my humble understanding. Mr. Moore, have I understood it right or wrong?
Right, yep. And that's had a significant bearing on my cross-examination.
Well, I was wondering why everybody was so happy with this, but it could be because what it is doing is catering for the Leaning Rock Cherries and of the world, of which not the only example. There are other people who have made the expenditure, incurred the debt, and the irrigation systems and everything else are in place. And so that's a potential pathway for them. But only 6 years. That's how the policy reads. Unless, of course, there's another interpretation, which Mr. Hodgkins will get to tomorrow, and I'll go, oh.
Yes. That's right, because I suppose that does, if that was the case, then that is different to what we had understood. So I had understood that a longer consent duration could be sought in this period of time if you could show the effects were less than minor.
No, that's not my understanding.
No, it's 6 years. I mean, the door's not slammed entirely. It's not prohibited beyond six, but you dip back in and it's pretty hard with an avoid policy.
Yeah,
to avoid.
So then, you know, you're not then just contending with the minor, no more than minor effects standard or test. You're also contending with the word avoid granting. And that's a pretty strong direction. So the door has been left open, but... it is a very narrow door. It's not a door necessarily to a long consent. It doesn't prohibit it. You could give it a go. But what do you think a decision maker is going to say when faced with an application for a 15-year consent when you've got avoid granting?
Well, I mean, I think Mr. Hodgson probably needs to answer this, but my understanding was that that was the point of the non-complying pathway, was that the 6 years was for the controlled activity in the RDA, and that if you could not meet that, if you sought, in fact, my understanding is if you were seeking new water, that you wouldn't be so much in the non-complying as in the old plan, but if you were seeking a renewal that didn't meet the controlled or REA, you would be in the non-complying pathway.
Do you know, if the policy applied the way you said, then we'd have everybody maintaining their non-complying track, I think. Oh, well, I don't know.
Well, they'd have to demonstrate
the not more than minor.
No more than minor.
Okay, so maybe it's not a matter for you, but it's a matter for your planner. But I think there's an interpretation issue. And even if they're even, you know, and maybe all that can be said is that the policy's not clear, although it seemed to me to be clear enough to me, but maybe that's just not so. In that case, we might have to look at the wording of the policy, either to go in your direction or to go in Mr. DePlal's maker's direction. But
yes, I think... Yeah. Perhaps, if that
which
was the case.
Then brings us to the question, do you have any questions? Because you've cross-examined on a different basis.
Possibly. I mean, to be fair, when I read the evidence last night, it was on the basis of having seen the planning evidence come through with the non-complying activity pathway as recommended by the planner. I do know this witness had put forward various statements in relation to the previous regime, but when I think about that, given that this witness is really appearing as a representative, as an advocate, I wonder whether I can cover that the territory with the planner tomorrow.
Probably, yep. Anyway, I understand where you'd like to go, or where you thought you could go, and we're going to cover it off with your witness tomorrow. But, okay, I've probably said enough.
Okay.
All right, but anyway, it's very important that we actually understand what you thought was happening. Yep. Yeah. Okay.
On the same topic, really, at 34A... You said we strongly support the controlled activity status. Did you understand that was a six-year term?
Yes, so that's right. So we accept the controlled and six-year term for those that meet the controlled activity standard to get a six-year term. And that was on the understanding that if you couldn't meet that, say, for example, you had a small area of... that you wanted to be larger, or you, for example, you were investing in something more significant and you had developed the effects, you could have done an effects assessment and show that the effects were minor, that you could use the non-complying pathway. So definitely the six-year duration I saw as a rollover for most people who would need to wait for the value setting and the allocation in the next plan in order to understand, in order to use the policies in that to justify a longer duration consent. But, so it was on the understanding that the non-compliant pathway was open. And the restricted discretionary for people who...
Sure.
..is 6 years as well, but for people who can't meet the calculation method.
Mm-hmm. And so reading Ms Ford's opening submissions, I see, Ms Ford, you thought that an applicant could advance a case for a longer-term consent. Yep. Don't think that's the case. Or if it is, it's not automatically that it's going to be interpreted that way. Yeah.
Yes, Your Honour, I suggest that we talk amongst ourselves as a team tonight just to confirm our understanding, going back to that section 104D wording, because my understanding is that there's the two limbs to that gateway test of either going back to that policy perspective or going under a no more than minor effects assessment, and that's where... Again, Mr. Hodson will be able to expand on this a bit more, where we thought we could get a longer-term consent through there.
Yeah. As matters stand, I think that's going to be difficult. Would that be fair?
Yes, before you get through the gate, but you still have to consider the policy.
You've got one gate, and that's the effects.
Yes. And that takes you to like a discretionary activity where you have to consider the planning documents and what they say.
Yeah.
So I think that it...
One gate and one gate only. You don't have... The two gates aren't open.
Just because you get through the gate doesn't mean that in terms of the matters that have to be considered over 1041, the weight that you would give to the policy and the way that it's worded.
So you need to talk about that as a team. In saying that, you know, the court is grappling with the difficult issue of people who have made an investment where they're able to show, like Leaning Rocks might be one, MacArthur Vineyard might be another, the infrastructure is actually in the ground. And so what's required is a bit more water, maybe, or a bit more land, or a bit more water anyway. Or it's in the ground, but it went in the ground after 2020. So a bit more land. So court is, you know, that's one scenario where we can see potential prejudice, although the cynic might say, well, jeepers, you took that risk on knowing jolly well that the permit would expire, you know, for deemed permits, permanent, you know, would expire October 2021 and four other permits 2025, and it could be, you know, you could take an approach that was a cynical step to take given those risks. Yeah.
Yes, I think one of the issues that has been canvassed is the lack of information around the allocation and where those limits are and over allocation of catchments, because that's different. So there might be a catchment that is over allocated where that risk would be quite high, that they knew that their permit was going to expire and they went ahead and did it anyway or not.
But that in itself could be seen as future-proofing activity.
You've got the other side of the coin where it could be quite reasonable, even if with water being over-allocation not being an issue in that catchment, that it could be quite reasonable to expect prior to the notification of this plan and when our growers were putting in orders for trees and planning for the future, that in a under-allocated or not over-allocated catchment, that it could be reasonable at that point to expect that they would have a consent to be able to application to be able to go through for a longer term than 6 years. And so I think that's where there could be inequalities in this plan.
Well, I think, as one expert said yesterday, for lamb and beef and lamb, risk might be tied to expectation, and an expectation, whether that expectation in terms of replacement consent is reasonably held is the open question at the moment. There's uncertainty throughout the country.
Yes.
And the question for the regional councils trying to grapple with is, how do you manage that uncertainty without opening up pathways for large-scale increases in land area or irrigation infrastructure, which can become stranded when the plan to come comes into being. And it's that plan, not this plan, which is the most uncertain element. Yeah. So... So that's what we're dealing with. Is there anybody that we can pull forward? And I thought you had actually provided a solution on the basis of still only a 6 year, but maybe not. We've got all sorts of options being presented to us: wholesale increases, 35 year permits, permitted activities, rejection of the plans, but. But in amongst that, there are people who have made that investment.
Yes, and that's where HortNZ seems to sit, is that comfortable, as far as possible, okay with that six-year consent for the controlled and restricted discretionary,
but I think the expectation is it was longer. If it is the advice that you should not be investing in anything less than a 15-year consent, then there's considerable risk.
Yes.
For considerable risk, I would have thought, in terms of what the land and water plan might say.
I mean, I feel that if you could demonstrate that the effects were less than minor, it seems to me that that would be a test that could stand the test of time.
Except how do you test that?
Well, that is the, no, I don't think it's an easy test in a non-complying activity. I think you would have to do the cumulative effects assessment.
I know, but you see, people have been arguing less than minor effects since, oh, I think about 30 years, and we've got to the water environment on the back
that
of
we
it
have,
that we have through
effect,
that assessment.
Yeah.
Mm. But and that's where the NPS is changing your thinking. It's no longer about that predictive exercise, but actually about what does this water body need.
Right, but I think you'd have to turn your mind to that in the non-compliant consent application.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying, gee, that's fraught. How can you... I mean, and I have said this in my decisions, so look it up. But I said, how on an effects-based assessment can you say, with your hand over your heart, yes, I'm confident to make a prediction as to effects, which effects on water quality might vary in time and space, which on a consent-by-consent, applicant-by-applicant basis is exceptionally hard to establish, which is why farmers are rightly aggrieved, because they have been told they are having minor effects, but that's not necessarily how it's actually panned out in the environment. So that's the environment. That is the framework that you're looking at this in, and I thought you'd made it a relatively easy way forward with the types of applications like Leaning Rock, just finishing off its or its development, MacArthur finishing off what it's got, but still on the basis of 6 years. So maybe you're not making it that easy.
I mean, that's certainly part of it, but I suppose we also thought of a case, perhaps a collective of growers who were able to undertake the sort of science at the scale that the regional council would be having to do, you know, catchment scale.
We've heard
scale.
That. Yes. We have heard you know, that for the last 4 weeks.
Yeah.
But we'll show you the science.
Well, I mean, they have to do it in a non-complying activity.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
well, actually, so every applicant that is looking for a 35-year consent, which I understand is most of them, under this plan change are all saying the same thing. We can show you the science. And it's not about... It has been about science-led outcomes. The thinking's changed. What are the needs of water as a body in its own right before we start treating it as a commodity and chopping it up? It's actually quite a different... It's a mental shift, yeah.
No, I mean, look, I totally understand that, and that's why I think that test has to be very tough, and that's why I don't think there should be cumulative effects allowed without that non-complying test.
Well, you know, in theory, they should never have been allowed anyway, so quite why we thought we could ignore them, who knows, but... Don't make it, do not create a rod for people's back by opening up the duration, given the risk, that is what I'm suggesting. But, I'm sure but I think your sector could be different, unless we've not heard enough from your sector to think about whether it's just the same as any other farming sector.
Mm. Well, I suppose our perception was that horticulture would have a chance of getting through that because of its lesser environmental impacts than some other activities. And so, but I think they would have to do a catchment scale, cumulative assessment, not the sort of effects assessments that we all did in the past.
Yeah, but you know,
where you just look at your little bit on top of and say it's no different. I'm not suggesting that.
But everybody did that effects assessment, notwithstanding the definition of effects included the cumulative effects. It's like, wow, you didn't look at that. But anyway, that's not for me. I've just got a transitional plan. Think about it, what you can or cannot reasonably secure out of this process. And we can come back to that tomorrow. You've got any questions following up from the court's comments?
No, Your Honour.
Yeah. All of this is hard.
Mm.
questions arising, but I'm not going to pursue any of them.
Yeah. That's not to indicate anything, because, you know, anything, it's a bit like throwing ideas out there. Oh, I wonder if you can make a voluntary... are there voluntary mechanisms that you can suggest in terms of bridging the gap in priorities? Well, I'm sure there's 10 things you can say that would prove that to be not a very worthwhile idea. But, yeah.
Oh, the thinking is certainly evolving,
yeah,
and the factual understanding is certainly increasing, which helps with that.
It's still
that.
A bit slow, that factual understanding, I think.
Yeah, I'm hopeful, perhaps like the bench, that we might get it when we hear from the actual abstractors in the next couple of weeks. But this uncertainty in relation to what the non-complying activity pathway might or might not provide for is a key issue, and rather than taking that up with this witness, I think we'll leave that for tomorrow.
Maybe it was tomorrow.
Yep. And as I said, the fact that this is in your planning witnesses brief, I didn't think people had particularly tucked into that policy in the JWS, because they weren't meant to be looking at those policies. And I understand they've gone and, as I said, done some editing to reflect the schedule, but I didn't think it was a wider look at the policies at all. So that's something to think about as well.
Just on that note, with Mr. Hodson being tomorrow and the extensive questions that Ms. Maher faced this morning, would there be any desire from the court to maybe start a little bit early, just being aware of the early cut-off?
Later. I've got so much work. Other work I have got to get to on this hearing. Well, that's really over to you and your accurate estimate of an uninterrupted go on your cross-examination.
I've got no credibility left when it comes to estimating timeframes, I'm told by Mr. Cooper and Ms. Jackson. When I was thinking about, it's a fair point, because we've got a hard cut-off at 2 o'clock tomorrow.
Yep.
When I'm thinking about the cross for Mr. Hodson, my cross prep, it was limited to two fairly narrow points, the date range and the breadth of the restricted discretionary activity rule. That was where I was focused, and bear in mind that there's a slight difference as between Mr. De Palsmaker and the other planners in relation to the restricted discretionary activity rule and the joint witness statement. Hortense Ed was not pursuing the type of restricted discretionary activity rule that Beef and Lamb were pursuing, and the vast majority of the questions this morning for Ms. Maher were in relation to that pathway. I didn't have any questions about the non-complying pathway because the council's content with that, and Mr. Hodgson said he agrees with it, or has said he agrees with it.
Yeah.
Now, if that situation changes, then I may require a little longer than my half an hour estimate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, one hour. Oh, no, that's reassuring.
You got an hour. yeah. Okay.
45.
We'll be in and out before morning tea. Yeah.
So how many more witnesses did
you
hear?
Two.
Just the two.
Mr. Hodson and then Mr. Webb as second grower.
My questions as short as they were today. From Mr. Hodgson.
Okay.
Yes. And I just want to make a point about the joint witness statement of planners.
Yep.
Mr. Farrell was specifically not there because it was about the schedule.
Yes.
And that will be why they quite responsibly didn't stray into the non-schedule related consequential changes that they might have wanted
so
to do.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised they even did some editing, but I do understand why they did the editing. It makes perfect sense, and probably you can't stop them when you get them in the room and they're wanting to do that anyway. So I did understand that, but as long as you understand that, you know, those policies do not by any means, not all planners signed up to them. In fact, some had very strong opinions against some of them. But they were just back-editing some necessary changes, that was all.
We'll discuss amongst ourselves tonight and come back tomorrow morning.
Yep, good. All right, so what, 9:30 or 10 o'clock start? No, I mean, I'm really happy to go with 10 because I don't think any of us have, we haven't got many, depends on how you go on cross-examination, but I haven't got many questions.
I think you've got a fair idea of where we're coming from in terms of the questioning, and your witness has been sitting down the back, presumably.
He's prepped for 10
minutes. He should be prepared.
So just make sure Mr. Hodgkins has our minute. He's got considerable experience, and that, like Ms. Maher, doesn't know a lot about deemed permits but knows a lot about planning, is able to assist the court on these other wider issues. What are the tools in the toolbox should we find as a gap and need to do something about it?
We will try our very best.
Very good. So that'll be my particular interest. All right, good. We're adjourned through to 10 with reasonable confidence that we will finish.
Right, please all stand.